You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is Susie Wyatt Clemons. On July 4th, 1992, Susie was informed that her boyfriend had AIDS and that he had known for years. However, Susie had not been informed. What happened then is the reason she wrote her story, Jewels in Her Crown, which includes a near-death experience. Tonight, we'll get to find out what happened to her and how that moment transformed her life forever. One of my friends and guests, Helen Luttrell, who wrote Rachel's Eyes, told me about Susie's story, so I'd like to thank you, Helen, for bringing her to my attention. So now, let's meet Susie and find out more about her story. Hi, Susie. How are you?
Well, hi, Lance. I'm doing just great, even though I'm a little warm down here in Payson, Arizona today.
Well, it's warm up here in Gold Country in El Dorado County as well. So we'll just sweat on the air together. Nobody will have to see it.
That's the nice thing about radio, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes. I didn't have to do my hair or anything.
I know, and I could sit here in my jammies, except they're a little too warm.
Right. Well, a swimming suit might be better.
Hey, there you go.
Now, what prompted you to write your book? We got kind of a brief glimmer of something going on here, Jewels in Her Crown, and then maybe you could also share with us how you chose the title for your story. How did this all begin?
Well, in 1992, I had met a gentleman that swept me off my feet, and I fell in love with him. And little did I know that in September, when he was put in hospital, he had informed me that he had just been told he had HIV. And, of course, my first test that I went and had the next week, of course, came back inconclusive. Back then, it took months to get our results back. And in January, I went and had another test done, and lo and behold, I was positive. And it wasn't until almost a year later, on 4th of July in 1993, that I overheard his mother tell his sisters that, oh no, Joe's known for years he's had HIV. And my whole world fell apart. I immediately went into the bathroom and threw up my life.
Wow.
And at 40 years old, this was... this just didn't happen to people like me. And we had a lot of misconceptions back then about HIV. And I've had, through the next 20 years, many experiences, many unique ones and many scary ones, many health issues, and many very happy moments. And so I've always known that I was going to write a book, but there were so many people that always said, when they'd hear part of my story, you've got to write a book. You've got to tell people what happened. And I knew I was going to write it. And then my brother and I moved down here to Payson, Arizona in December of 2009. And in and early spring, I received a small inheritance from my grandfather, at which time we went and bought a computer. And I knew I needed the computer to write my book. So that's how I started writing it. I didn't know when we moved here of an ending for my book, so I never thought about doing it because I couldn't get an ending to it. And it wasn't until I went to a retreat for people affected with HIV/AIDS here in Sedona. Can you imagine going to a retreat in Sedona?
It was
quite nice. And
yeah.
And I thought I was going to go up there and shed all of my wisdom upon all of these people. And little did I know that it was a big reminder of where I came from and when I started. And when I started driving home, I was crying so hard I had to pull off the side of the road because it all of a sudden dawned on me I had the ending to my book. I had come full circle. From the very first retreat I went to in Spokane, Washington in 1993 and until this one in 2010. And that's what got me to write my book.
Interesting. Now, you've apparently moved through many phases with this infection or with this virus that I share with you. I have the same thing. I've had it for over 30 years now, so we're both long-term survivors.
Yeah, how about that?
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I know for myself, I went through a long period where I thought it was a death sentence, and
yes.
I was quite self-destructive in many ways with the alcohol and drugs and lifestyle choices. Did you go through something similar, or what was your initial breakdown?
Actually, I didn't go through the drugs and alcohol, although I did smoke pot quite a bit back then. But I guess I was in such a state of shock when I originally found out that all I did, I say in my book, I went through a crying time, and that crying time lasted well over a year where I cried nonstop all day.
Mm.
I was just so totally devastated. And I was a single mom. I had two children raised and out of the house and working on my third teenager. And I dated very little. I worked in a hospital and environmental services. And so when I finally did start to date, the only reason why I would wear a condom back then was so I wouldn't get pregnant.
Right.
You know, just started hearing about HIV coming into the heterosexual world, so to speak, and I never thought about a 40-year-old soccer woman, you know, Caucasian, raising three kids, falling into a category where I had to worry about contracting HIV.
That just didn't
happen back then.
That's right.
Of course, we soon found out that that just totally exploded in suburbia USA.
Right.
You know, so it was a devastating shock for me, and my health is what turned me downwards. It seemed like, you know, I just, because of where I was mentally in this state, and scared to death, he had threatened so many times to kill me and my daughter, and our relationship became very volatile once I became infected.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid to do anything, and it wasn't until I overheard this conversation in 1993 that I had gone home, and my brother, youngest brother, contacted me and asked if he could rent out my basement so he could save some money to get through the winter. He was a seasonal worker.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my God, there's my lifeline. He can't hurt me with my brother here.
And that's
exactly what happened. And then I reached out for help. I called the National AIDS Hotline, and I have no idea how that person even understood what I was saying because I cried through the whole thing. But somehow they got in touch with Spokane AIDS Network, and they followed up within an hour and called me and had someone out to my house within a couple of hours. And that was my lifeline.
Well, wonderful.
Yeah, next to my brother, of course.
Now, you must have had to go back and confront your boyfriend with the information that his mother had shared with the family that was open knowledge. What happened when you told him that you knew that he had had it for years and hadn't told you?
Actually, that never happened.
Oh, it didn't?
He never knew that I heard the truth from his mom. She never knew that I overheard that conversation until much later.
Okay.
It was in 1994 when I had been so convinced that what happened to me was a crime that I went to some attorneys out in the valley and told them what happened. And they said, oh boy, he says, you don't need us. He said, you need a detective.
Mm-hmm.
And he put me in touch with a wonderful man in the Spokane Police Department. And I made an appointment and went in and told my story to him. He said he would get back to me, and in a couple weeks he did. And in another couple weeks I was in his office and the prosecuting attorney's office. And before I knew it, this was blowing up into a full-scale criminal first-degree murder charge.
Wow.
And it was a precedent case for Washington State. And and I remember Detective Jimmy telling me, or asked me, he said, do you have a gun? And I go, no. And he says, I would suggest you get one. And coming from a detective, you know, I just wanted to throw up all over again. And he said, and he says, and I want you to get a protective order. And I looked at him, I just started crying, and I says, you don't understand. I would be signing my own death warrant doing that.
Uh-huh.
That's nothing. A piece of paper is nothing. You know, and of course, I had been convinced he was going to kill me anyway, so it was like, oh, why add fuel to the fire?
Wow.
And I remember doing that. I remember going in to, and talking to a judge, and when he signed the order, I told him, I says, please remember who I am, because if I come up dead, it will not be an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what started it all. We never did get all the way through the criminal case because he was found to have dementia, severe dementia, and which is a condition with advanced AIDS patients.
Mm-hmm.
And but because he had already admitted to infecting me, he ended up in a criminal hospital, and that's where he died.
Oh, really? When did he cross over?
I do not know.
Oh, interesting.
I do not know. I chose not to look into that.
Well, yeah.
I just know that it happened.
Wow.
And it was in 1996, 95 maybe, I went back to the same attorneys and for a civil case because we had found out that Jeff had been convicted of black tar heroin charges and a conviction in prison. And he used his status of being HIV positive for a sentence downward, which he was granted, which also put him in a category of having no confidentiality with his HIV status.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very rare. And my attorneys were able to find that, and we ended up in civil case charging the Department of Corrections with knowingly allowing me to become infected.
Wow.
I know. Yeah. It was just a whirlwind. You know, it was just one thing after another after another. And I was just running on I don't know, air.
Right, know? Right. Now, yeah. How did your health fare after you found out? Were you healthy for a long time? Did you ever have opportunistic infections? Or?
Yes. I became sick from the get-go. I don't know if it was just because of the shock. And the fear and the guilt, the shame, the anger of all of it that you know that just fed on this virus just going rampant in my system.
Uh-huh.
But I started becoming sick right away and started coming down with some really crazy things. Not only did they initially overdosed me on AZT, which was about the only thing we had at the time.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That, of course, made me pretty ill. But also found that I started coming down with some really strange stuff and really, really odd illnesses. I had moved over to Aberdeen, Washington, and it was just after my civil case when I started getting these boils throughout my body.
Huh.
And I'd been going to one doctor after another, you know, one antibiotic after another, and until I finally had gone through several of them, and it was just all over me, and it metastasized in my breast.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember going to the last doctor in Aberdeen, and he said, oh, well, let's try one more antibiotic. Well, about this time, I pretty much had it. I was in so much pain. I was so sick. I just had it, and I just screamed at this doctor, if these boils were in your balls, you would have them cut off in a minute. And just went screaming out of, this doctor's office, and walking home. I had about 8 blocks to walk home, and just stomping. I was angry. I was tired. I was sick. I was in pain, and nobody was listening to me. And I picked this book out of my book bag that a friend had given me earlier that day. It was Louise Hay's book, Heal Thyself.
Yeah.
So I started looking up a couple of things, and I looked up the word boils, and in it it says anger within. Well, that just ticked me off all the more, let me tell you, and I was so upset. I don't even want to use the dirty words that I was saying, and I threw that book across the road and went stomping home, and got about a block down the road, and I go, oh, something made me turn around and go back and get the book. And so I did, and I eventually made it home, and I was crying, and I just wanted to get home and just get stoned out of my mind and maybe take away some of this pain that I was in, because that's the only thing they had me on was medical marijuana.
Wow.
And so I get home, and the phone rings, and I don't know why I answered it, but I did, and it just so happened to be my case manager in Aberdeen, Washington. And he had said, Susie, I think we have found someone that can help you.
Mm.
And I go, well, you better tell me because I'm about ready to end it all. And I've never been suicidal, but maybe I was at that point, you know, to say something like that. And he said, Susie, there is a hospital up in Seattle, Washington called Virginia Mason Hospital. And he said, they have a whole wing of the hospital dedicated to people with HIV/AIDS. They will know what's wrong with you.
Wonderful.
He says, can I pick you up tomorrow morning and take you up there? And I'm going, yes, you know, crying hysterically, like maybe there was some hope. And sure enough, they did. They didn't know what it was or what caused it, but they knew it was an AIDS-defining infection.
Right.
And this was in 1999.
Wow.
And, of course, back then, that's where they put everything that they didn't know about in that category.
Mm-hmm. Right,
but
right.
My only alternative is to get rid of this infection because it was starting to spread to my brain. And no wonder I was a little loopy.
Well, at least you had an excuse.
And a little hysterical maybe, too, huh?
Yeah, just a bit. Understandably so.
Yeah, so anyway, so... We made arrangements within the next. I'd be back up there in 5 days, and I would be having a radical mastectomy, which meant they would take some lymph nodes out of my left side and both of my breasts off, and hopefully be able to stave off this infection. And just before this happened, I had called my friend Steven and his partner. They came over to my house in Aberdeen, and Les was a Reiki master, and a Reiki master is a healer.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he belonged to a group of people out in this place out in the Wenatchee River, and that he wanted me to come out tomorrow night so they could all do a healing on me. And I go, yeah, okay, whatever helps, you know. I didn't know anything about that. And so I went out there and met these people, and I laid on this table, and they did this healing with their hands, and they didn't necessarily touch you.
Mm.
But boy, oh boy, you could just feel the electricity in the air, and your hair would stand up on your arms, you know. You kind of knew something was different, but not really knowing what.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did all of this, and then I went home that night, and of course a few days later, the night before I left for the hospital, Les and Stephen called and said that they would be doing ascending Reiki treatment on me, which meant while I was leaving for the hospital in the morning, that they would be sending this healing to me throughout the day.
Oh, nice.
And so I go, okay, cool, whatever.
Right.
And so I go in, I have my surgery, I get back in my room and everything, and they hook me up to all these monitors, and I'm just wide awake. And I am the happiest person in the whole world because the first time in months, I'm pain-free. I just immediately, I am pain free. And doctor walks into the room and he says, I don't really know what's going on, but your lab work is coming back really strange. And I go, well, what do you mean? He said, you shouldn't be feeling this good and you shouldn't have been responding to surgery this fast. And we don't know why you're healing as quickly as you are, but we're going to monitor it.
Right.
Go, okay, cool. I'm just flying high, and it doesn't have anything to do with medication.
Oh.
And so 30 hours later, I'm released from the hospital, and they were planning on keeping me there for over 10 days.
Wow.
And I get home, and I've got these little drain tubes in me, so I've got to clear those all out. And I've got a nurse coming by and checking on me. But that was my very first experience of a pure healing from a group of people, and it was called Reiki.
Wow,
that's when I started to heal. I've had other things that have been death-defying along the way also.
Uh-huh.
Since then, I've had two heart attacks, three blood clots, and the second one almost took my life, and it was a deadly one.
Now, you had a near-death experience somewhere along the line, yes?
That's the second blood clot. Yeah,
What was that like?
Well, I had started on a spiritual journey after my Reiki treatment and after my my breasts were removed, and my brother Les and my friend Stephen, they moved me down to Klamath Falls with them, and I got to thinking, you know, there's got to be something more to this life than just this, you know what. What is going on? And I needed answers, so I started searching for answers. And the answers came in some very strange situations and strange people. But I had started on a spiritual journey. And a spiritual journey was a couple of statements that I grew up with throughout my whole life. One of them was my mom's, and it was, behind every dark cloud is a silver lining. You just have to look for it. And the other one is a story that my grandma told me as a child that stayed with me throughout all of these years. And it was, Susie, for every full circle in your life, and a full circle is a lesson learned, a jewel will be placed in your crown to be placed on your head when you get to heaven.
Mm.
So that's how I got the title Jewels in Her Crown for my book.
Oh, how interesting.
I started on this journey, and it had a few different things happen. A couple heart attacks, they were mild. Had a stent put in my heart, and then a blood clot in my leg. And then in 2006, I went back up to Spokane to visit my family and my daughter. And while I was there, my leg kept going numb and kind of cold on me, and it was August up there. It was nice and warm up there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the day before I was to leave to come home, I was in the pool with my daughter, and I said, you know, Sarah, I said, maybe I should, you know, go into emergency and have this checked before I head home. You know, I know they're going to tell me it's nothing, but, you know, maybe I should have it checked. And she said, yeah, you probably should, Mom. So we get out of the pool and go into emergency hospital, and they come back about an hour later saying, we're going to take you down to Sacred Heart Hospital. And I go, why? And they says, well, because we're just not quite sure what's going on with your leg.
Hmm.
And I go, okay. And my daughter says, well, I'll go pick up your grandson from school, or from his friend's house, actually, and I'll meet you down at the hospital. And I go, okay. So they whisk me off in an ambulance. I'm chatting all the way, and I get to the hospital, and they put me on the gurney, and that's the last thing I remember for 12 days.
Wow.
The last thing I remember. And my family has had to fill in some pieces of the puzzle, because I don't remember those next 12 days at all. What I do remember is frightful and scary. I was in CCU for those 12 days, not expected to live, and definitely not expected to have my leg if I did happen to live through it.
Wow.
And my family told me later, you know, weeks and months years later that, you know, I carried on conversations with them.
Huh.
But I have no memory of it whatsoever. And this is what I remember. And this is a very powerful part of my life. So if I get a little emotional at times, I hope everybody kind of understands.
Okay.
But I remember looking down at a hospital bed with me in there, in this bed. And I did not look well at all. I had a very kind of grayish color to me. I wasn't pink and white and fleshy like we usually are. And I saw my family standing around my bed. I saw my daughter crying. And I looked at this body, and I just said, oh, Susie, you're not doing too good. And the next thing I know, I'm moving. I'm out of the hospital, and I'm moving. And I end up in a really kind of a beautiful, soft, white light, a warm light. I can't say it's brilliant. I can't say it's white. It's just comforting.
Uh-huh.
And there's no floor, like it's foggy in there.
Uh-huh.
And I see my mom and dad. My mom and dad have been dead for years. I go, oh, cool. So visit with them for a while. And I see my great-grandma, Maher, and I visit with her. And a lot of people in there that I don't recognize, but they all knew me.
Huh.
And my friend Georgie was there. He's the only Marine I know that could walk in high heel shoes better than me. and I heard my friend Gail's voice, but I never saw, but I heard her voice. And I just kind of just went around and just visited, and periodically I would look down at my right ankle, and I had this thread, this beautiful, brilliant, gorgeous, thin gold thread wrapped around my ankle. But I never got tangled up in it, and to this day that just floors me. I kept thinking, why am I not getting tangled up in this thing, and what's it tethered to, you know? What's
uh-huh.
it go to? I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like I was only there for a very short period of time.
Uh-huh.
And the next thing I knew, I was leaving. And then nothing said that you need to go back now, or it's you have to go back, your work's not done. I didn't hear anything like that. I just all of a sudden knew it was time for me to go back.
Huh.
And I went back in this body that was in such horrendous pain. I'm waking up screaming in pain. And the nurses are coming in trying to quiet me, and they've got me on the highest dose of morphine they can. It's not working.
Mm-hmm.
I am screaming, there's something wrong with my leg. Well, of course there's something wrong with your leg, honey. You just had surgery on it. And I go, no, it's not like that. There's something wrong with it. They wouldn't listen. You know, they kept trying to tell me it's just because of the surgery that I just had, and da-da-da. But at least I knew then I had still had a leg.
Right.
And something just wasn't right. I don't know how I did it, but I ended up calling my daughter at home and telling her, Sarah, there's something wrong with my leg, and they're not listening to me. There's something wrong with my leg. And so all my family came right back to the hospital and demanded that they get the doctor on the line, that she would not be acting like this unless there's something really wrong.
Mm.
What ended up happening was this on-call doctor came in, and he was not happy with me at all, and he was not pleasant with me. Of course, how could you be? You've got a patient there screaming bloody murder, waking up the whole hospital floor.
Mm-hmm.
And all the time my doctor told this doctor to take that bandage off, take the staples out, and just put butterfly bandages on her leg.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what they were doing, and they were helping me to remember to breathe, because if I breathed real deeply and concentrated on it, I wasn't screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And pain. And I remember when they took the bandage off, I felt better. I didn't even feel them take the metal staples out of my leg. That's how much pain I was in.
Mm.
Come to find out the next day that had they not gotten that bandage off of me within 2 hours, I would have died.
Wow.
It was too tight.
Oh.
And it was
that was going, what was wrong with your leg.
Well, that's what was wrong with my leg when I came back into my body. And isn't it absolutely amazing? This strikes me odd to this day, the timing of everything. How I came back into this body at just the perfect time to save my life.
Oh, yeah.
And I've never been comfortable calling it an out-of-body experience. I've never been comfortable calling it a near-death experience. I call it I went to the ethers.
Right.
Because that's kind of all I know. I've heard Danyon Brinkley's stories. I've heard other near-death experiences. And mine just didn't quite fit into their box. And so I'm comfortable calling it I went to the ethers and came back.
Well, that
but
makes
that's
a lot
not
of sense.
The end of the story.
Oh, okay. It slices, it dices.
I know it. It just keeps going on like the Energizer Bunny Rabbit, right? I tell you, my life has been absolutely amazing. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
I was in the hospital, maybe 21, 24 days altogether. And the fourth day before I was going to be released to go back to Sarah's house to recuperate, I was sitting in a chair. I'd just been getting up 3 or 4 days before that and learning how to re-walk again because my leg didn't know how to walk. And so I was just sitting in this chair. I had a beautiful hospital room with a beautiful panoramic view of downtown Spokane, which, you know, in the summertime is just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just sitting in my chair, looking out this window, just really pondering what's happened to me and how I still have my leg and how I'm going to learn to walk and what I'm going to do. And all of a sudden, my mom and dad walk in my room. Well, my mom and dad had been dead for years, remember? I was talking to them in the ethers not too long ago.
right.
And I always had the curtain pulled in my bedroom, but the door open so it wouldn't get too warm in there because I didn't like people just looking into hospital rooms.
Right.
You know, and I catch myself when I'm in a hospital now not to do that.
Right.
Because I know how I felt when that happened. So I always had my curtain pulled. Well, here my mom and dad walk into my room, and I look at them like that's normal. And I'm sitting in my chair, and they come over to my chair. And what struck me as really odd is my mom was in her pink outfit, which she just absolutely loved all the time. And my dad was in his jeans and his plaid shirt, and they were holding hands. And I'd never seen my mom and dad hold hands. But they were holding hands, and they came towards me, and my mom was over on my left side, and my dad was over on my right side, and they put their arms around me, and they each kissed me on my temple, and I can feel that to this very day, their kiss. And they had told me, Susie, your work is not done, but we're here with you. And I remember they had their arms around me, and I went to touch their arms, and their arms felt like feathers. I'll never forget that. I'll never, ever forget that. And then they just walked out of the room holding hands, and I just sat there like, nobody's going to believe this.
Wow.
And did this just really happen?
Uh-huh.
You know, now they couldn't say it had to do with the morphine I was on, because I wasn't on any.
right.
So
that's amazing.
That was absolutely amazing. The sad part for me of all of this was that not only did I have to recuperate at my daughter's place for 6 weeks doing therapy, or it could have been a month, but I had to go back to Sprague River, Oregon, where I was living with my adopted brother, Les. Stephen's partner, and Stephen had already passed, but we'd been living together for years, and I loved living there. And all of a sudden, I found myself having to move back to Spokane, and I was very sad. I was very angry. I was going to leave a life that I loved. To go back to live in a dinky little apartment, you know, and but you know, it was, you know, special housing. It was a clean place. It was a safe, pretty place, but it wasn't home.
Right.
And all I knew was that I had to go back to Spokane for a year, and hopefully, I would have enough of my leg left that I could be have a normal life with it through therapy. And I worked and worked and worked and worked, and I walked miles, and I just to make sure that someday, maybe someday, I could move back. And a year later, I did move back. And unbeknown, my doctor had no idea that I would be able to heal like that, but I did. Perseverance and stubbornness, I guess. But, you know, one of the other things I wanted to share with you tonight was when I was living in Klamath Falls, and this was in about 2001, I had been going to a group, all of us had been going to a group session of like-minded people, just get gathering on every other Sunday, because it just didn't seem like we were fitting in any normal church. And we tried the Unitarian Church, and it just didn't seem to really be meeting our needs at the time. And then we heard about this guy called Swami, and I didn't know what a Swami was, but it's Swami Thai. And so we went to his group, and it was really cool. They talked about really neat things that no one ever talked about before, you know. And they talked about UFOs, and we talked about chemtrails, and we talked about near-death experiences and soul retrieval and UFOs and such a variety of things. It was like, oh, my God, this is really interesting stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
And, of course, by then I'd been listening to Art Bell on Coast to Coast AM for several years, so I was kind of familiar with the out of the box type stuff.
Oh yes,
and to meet this man who had such a beautiful way of talking about things. He taught me how to meditate, and he taught me the difference between prayer and meditation, because I got really confused when we were supposed to meditate about all the people in the world and send in these warm, fuzzy feelings, you know. Well, what's that going to do, you know? And,
right.
and because all my life I'd been used to praying, well, you know, I was kind of having a problem with this, with man-made God, and why some prayers were answered and some weren't, and why some children died and some children were abused, and why all of this?
Mm-hmm.
And so I started really paying attention to the Swami guy, and really got to know him. And I asked him one time, I said, Swami, how would you describe you? Because I had no idea. I mean, he was born and raised a Catholic. His grandmother was an Indian shaman. He'd been all over the world studying religions, you know. Who is this guy? And why does he wear this crazy outfit and call himself a Swami?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know at the time that Swami was a title. And so it just means a spiritual teacher is really all it means.
Right, right.
And so I asked him, I says, how would you describe you? And he said, well, Susie, he said, I'm everything and nothing, just like you. And I go, well, what's that mean? He says, well, you just think about it. You just ponder it. This man never, ever gave me a direct answer to any of my questions. He always made me think.
Sounds like he might have known something.
He most definitely did, because what happened in one of these classes, he was talking about soul retrieval. And soul retrieval means when there's another person in your life. It could be that you had a close connection to, positive or negative, that have are no longer in your life or causing strife in your life or passed on, a variety of things. But they have a part of your soul. You've given them that. And you need to go back and get that. And I got to thinking immediately about Joe.
Oh.
And I go, oh, my God, how in the world can I do this?
Uh-huh.
I said, he's dead. I'm doomed. I don't, you know, he's got this piece of me, and Swami, I've got a piece of him. How do I give that back? And he says, well, and I said, would you help me with this? And he gives me this book, and he says, read this book. I was on soul retrieval. I go, oh, geez, and more work. So
right.
I go home, and the next day I start reading it, and I read the whole thing. I just couldn't put it down. It resonated with me so much, I could not put it down. And
what was the name of the book, by the way?
You know, I'm thinking it was called Soul Retrieval.
Okay, all right.
Because that's really all I remember about it.
Okay.
And because he said, read the book, and when we meet up in a couple weeks, we will discuss this.
Mm-hmm,
okay,
mm-hmm.
So I read the book, find out really what it is, and yeah, that's exactly not only what I need, but what I need to do. And a few days, it must have been a Thursday, Friday, before we were to meet up with our Swami group on Sunday, that I had a dream that night. And in that dream, I went into the space, I will call it the ethers, because that's all I'm familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, I had the foggy floor.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a table and two chairs, and they looked just like the old ice cream parlor table and chairs with the red and white stripes and stuff on them.
That's
what it looked like in there.
Okay.
And I'm walking towards this table and chairs, and then I see Jeff, and he's walking towards me, and he's got a smile on his face, and I'm smiling.
Oh.
Here,
okay.
I'm meeting up with this guy that gave me a death sentence, and I've tried to sue the death out of.
Uh-huh.
And he's smiling at me. And we sit down, and we talk. We have a wonderful conversation. Cannot tell you a single word that I said. I do not know.
Uh-huh.
I do not remember. But I remember when we were sitting there towards the end of our conversation, and he held out his hand and opened up his palm, and it looked like a small, tiny pebble in his hand. And I took it, and it was part of my soul. And I put my hand out and uncurled it, and the same thing, it was in my hand, and he took it. I don't know how it got there, but he took that.
Wow.
And I remember saying at the time, will you please forgive me? And he said, will you forgive me?
Wow.
And that put me on my whole path, my whole journey that I've been on for the last 20 years. So
wow.
When the book came about, when I got my hands on the computer, took me a couple of weeks to learn how to turn it on,
right.
and another couple of weeks to kind of figure out how I was going to set this up and type this, and the Geek Squad gave me a flash drive to put everything on, and my neighbor across the street came over to help me because I didn't even know what a flash drive was, and just showed me how to just start and how to save and how to back it up each time, that within 2 months I had my book written.
Wow. So it just flowed out of you. Now, did you were able to see in the ethers that you and Jeff, I guess his name is.
His real name is Jeff. You know, I kept forgetting because in the book it's Joe, because I didn't think I needed to say his real name,
okay.
But I messed up.
Right. Well, Mr. X,
there you go.
who is no longer a mystery. You both had a soul agreement, apparently. Do you feel that you had made that prior to coming to incarnating for the lessons that it would provide?
Absolutely. You know, I have been blessed by having an amazing group of books come my way.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And one of the books that put it all together for me was called The Soul's Plan. And I would recommend that. I would recommend that book before I'd recommend mine.
Do you know who wrote that one?
Well, I will look it up while we're talking.
Okay. All right.
that's as good as I can get right now.
I've had several guests on the show who have talked about the interlife, the life between life and death, and the life between near-death experience. And there are some fascinating books out there that talk about our experiences that are so vast and so complex and so simple on the other hand, that they are mind-boggling and just wonderful, wonderful reads and very educational. So, yes, all of these things are helpful for us to be able to read and learn about others' experiences when we don't necessarily have to have them.
Well, and that's so true because especially the last one, The Soul's Plan, and it's by Robert Schwartz.
Oh, I bet. Yes,
Schwartz.
Yeah, he's been on the show. That's one of my favorite books.
Oh my God! He's your neighbor?
No, he's not. I just had him on the show. Years
well,
ago,
the next time you talk to him, you tell him that I love him.
I will do that. I've had several people mention his name, and he's one of the most popular writers about this subject.
I've got him mentioned in my book list.
Wonderful. Well, he'll be happy to know that.
It put everything together for me.
He's a brilliant writer.
Of my questions, and how God works, what is the soul, how the soul works,
mm-hmm.
why do we go through the things we do in life, and why
mm-hmm.
do we hook up with the people that we do in our life?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well,
exactly.
You know, you and I have had similar parallel courses in that we both had experiences with this, with the virus HIV, and both of us for a long time. So, you know, I've seen many people die from this. One of my best friends died in my arms, and I was actually there when he took his last breath. And
that's
so,
a gift.
You know, that was something that you have to experience at least once in your many lifetimes. But
it's a beautiful gift that is given to us who survive, that they love and trust us enough to let us walk them through that.
Absolutely right. I totally agree with you. Now, I know that some people are going to be curious about the name of your Swami. They're going to want to know who that is. So is it permissible to give his name out on the air?
Well, I already have it. Swami Thai.
Swami Thai.
S-W-A-M-I-I or M-M-I. I've never been sure of the spelling,
okay.
But it's spelled T-Y. And he's in Cedarville, California.
Okay.
But he goes to Klamath Falls, Oregon twice a month.
Wonderful.
And he's in Medford twice a month. So.
Wonderful.
So I've...
Well, it's good to have these little leads that we get. Somebody might be inspired to look him up and find out more about him. And, you know, that's one of the wonderful things about the bright lights that are here on the planet. And we're all bright lights, whether we know it or acknowledge it or not. You and I have come close to death probably more times than we care to admit. And yet here we are, against all odds.
Yeah.
And you must have finally found that you do have work left to do, and that was why you had to return. Do you feel that writing the book was part of that?
I really do. Mm-hmm. I do that. I still had some lessons to learn and some growth to do before I wrote the book, and it's ironic that it happened down here in Payson, Arizona. It's amazing how it happened the way it did.
Mm-hmm.
But it also brought out something else in me that's been nagging at the back of my brain for years. And that is, when I went to my first retreat in Spokane, Washington, it was in 1993, and it was called Strength for the Journey. And Strength for the Journey are national retreats put on by the United Methodist Church for people infected and affected with HIV.
Mm.
And my first retreat I went to was in 1993, and of course, I had just, you know, met with the detectives and they're investigating my case, you know, and I got hooked up to go to this retreat and it came at a perfect opportunity because Joe was going to be served notice that they were looking for him and I wasn't going to be at home, so he couldn't come and kill me.
Right.
But I remember when I walked in into the building and I froze. I was just in a state of shock. And this beautiful man by the name of Patrick Franz, who has passed since, came up to me and he said, "You must be Susie." And I, "Uh-huh, yeah." And I'm looking, all of these people in pajamas, and they have these big black blotches on them and IV poles.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I just burst out, you know, in wheelchairs, and I just burst out crying because I'm thinking, oh, my God, that's going to be me in a few years.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just helped me and guided me through the whole process. He says, there's a woman here I want you to meet, and she's really excited about meeting you. And her name was Lenny. And Lenny and I became very good friends. Lynn was one of the first women diagnosed with HIV in Spokane. And at the time, she was a seven-year long-term survivor.
Right, right. That's a piece of cake these days.
Yeah. And her and I became very, very, very best friends. But from that retreat, was my very first retreat. All people infected, doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, we were all together. It was all a group thing. And I will say this, that had it not been for the gay community in Spokane, Washington, that pushed me to go further with these cases and to stand my ground and to do it and to come out and be that poster girl for this spreading this disease is criminal. And it was because they couldn't. And so many of them would say, you go, girl, you know, I was infected the same way, but because I was infected by a man, they won't even listen to me.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
And that was the mentality back there, as if certain people deserved it.
Well, that mentality, unfortunately, still exists.
It still does, but I'm here to break down some barriers.
Oh, well,
and
God bless you.
I don't care whose toes I step on, because my biggest issue is stop treating us women like the men.
Yeah.
We are completely different. We have completely different medical needs. We become infected with things that men can't come infected with, like early detection of breast cancer, cervical cancer, urinary, all of the women things. Menopause, we go through much sooner with this diseasement. And I also found out something else, that women will not bond and they will not open up in a mixed group of people.
Huh.
I've had this happen on three different occasions where I just happened to be a part of a group of just women.
Uh-huh.
And it is so completely different. We break down and cry. We get angry at how our husbands and our boyfriends infected us, and how we had to take care of them, and then they died, and no one's taking care of us.
Mm-hmm.
And still carrying that anger
mm-hmm.
of how they
mm-hmm.
became infected, because they were never able to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They were never able to get it out of there and start to heal from it, and then down the road forgive because of it.
So the main elements that seem to be operating, I know for myself and many others I've seen, have to do with releasing the anger, letting go of that, forgiving, and then having the ability to love and see the interconnectedness of everything and how synchronicity plays its part in our lives for our benefit, that all of our hardships are really designed basically by us for the soul growth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for us that can, to be strong enough to help those that cannot.
Yes. And those who have such immense hardships have really taken on the greatest burdens because of the amount of soul growth that it provides for themselves mm-hmm. and for those around them.
Yes.
Yeah.
When I realized that I chose all of this,
I
was going, what the hell are you thinking, girl?
Yeah, I said the same thing.
I bet. It's like, oh, my God, people. You know, and then my younger brother who moved down here in December, and he was a very, very sick man when we picked him up at the hospital. at the airport. And in about 3 months later, he died. And he died of cirrhosis of the liver. And just Les and I both felt very honored and blessed to help Mike through all of that and to help him understand, number one, that his soul chose all of this for life lessons for mm-hmm. him to learn, that he does not have to come back in another lifetime and learn this again.
Right.
If he learns forgiveness for himself from it before he goes.
Yes, yes.
And he was. So it's not, this isn't just about people learning how not only to forgive others, but forgive ourselves. That was a hard one for me to do because I didn't think I had any forgiving of myself. I blamed Jeff or Joe,
right.
AKA.
Mr. X, yeah.
For everything.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
all his fault, 100%.
Yeah.
And what
about
Swami Chai had taught me
seconds.
Was
okay.
that if you just one speck of ownership, you have to take all of it to heal.
Yes, yes. Well, Susie, we're just about out of time, and I wanted to make sure that you had time to mention your website before we go.
Well, my book is Jewels in Her Crown, and it's sold on Amazon.com and also in ebooks. And the web page is www.jewelsinhercrown.com. But we are having a little bit of difficulty with my web page at the moment. So periodically check back weekly to make sure it's up and running. And I also have developed for women-only classes and lectures that I also have listed on there for different bookings for retreats or seminars. And that'll be on the web page. And when it's completely all up and running, then it'll be on there. But it's www.jewelsinhercrown.com.
Wonderful. Well, Susie, thank you so much for sharing your life with us today. And
it was a pleasure
talking to you.
Let's do it again. We have more to talk about.
All righty.
And namaste to everybody.
Okay. Good night.
Thank you.